Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. I'm Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And, you know, Julie, I was just thinking the other day about how we're just approaching 50 years of humans going into space.
Right.
Like, I think it's like the next April, I think, is when we'll reach that point. 50 years. Of humans blasting up on the tip of control explosions into orbit, hanging out in microgravity, and then coming back. And I was in researching what we're going to talk about today, I was thinking, what if everybody who had come back from space came back like just completely changed in terms of their mental outlook on life and the universe,
right?
To the point where it was just like you had space people returning to the planet.
Well, and you know, my question is, aren't they completely changed? I mean, wouldn't they just be inherently changed from that experience?
Well,
on some level,
I think they generally are. I mean, you hear people talk about like I was talking to one of the Virgin Galactic dudes about the whole cell on Virgin Galactic, which of course Virgin Galactic is the space tourist thing that's going to eventually start here.
Right.
Richard Branson's brainchild.
Yeah. I like how you just dropped that. Yeah. I was just talking to like the Virgin Galactic guy, you know.
Well, not, well, I should,
I was talking about my seat on the flight.
All right. I was not talking to Richard, just one of Richard's.
Okay. All right. Just to clarify.
Yeah. It was for an article. It wasn't like we weren't hanging out, you know.
All right.
But, I was asking him, like, you know, about the cell of you know, shooting people into space and whether the what they were offering was gonna, you know, really please people, or if people would be like, whoa, what was that? That was whack. I thought I was gonna have a little more of a space experience there. But
right, these seats are awful.
Yeah,
yeah.
But he was like, no, it's gonna deliver, and because people go into space, and when they go into space, that's something they talk about for the rest of their lives. Like, it becomes this defining experience.
Right.
So,
defining moment of their life story.
So, yeah. So I think on one level, yes, it does change people. But the big thing we're going to talk about today is this thing called the overview effect, which, entails, or at least, or at least it implies that there are greater changes going on in at least the human outlook.
Right. And this is a relatively new term, right? The overview effect.
Right.
It was described by Frank White, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and he was talking about this common thread that runs through astronauts and their experience when they're out in space and they just kind of look over their shoulder, or maybe they're making a repair or something, or they're spacewalking.
Yeah, doing Mad Libs or something.
Yeah, you know, yeah. just as you would be doing on the moon. And they happen to look over at Earth and they're just blown away in this sense of euphoria.
Yeah, I'm picturing like a double take. You know, it's like, all right, repairing the moon buggy, repairing the moon buggy, and then you sort of glance and you're like, huh? Whoa, and then it just all sinks in.
Right, right. And for a couple of these astronauts, it's been completely life-changing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's made them reconsider humanity, our role on the Earth and in the universe. And some interesting things have come out of that.
Yeah. There's if you back up a little bit to the 1950s, early 1950s even, you had psychologists studying aviation pilots. And they had something already called the breakaway effect, and this was just generally solo pilots flying at high altitudes having this experience where they're just like whoa, they feel this strange feeling of detachment from the Earth, you know, like I say, generally during solo missions, and it's kind of this spiritual sensation.
Yeah, well, and I think. To me, the most interesting part of this is astronaut Edgar Mitchell, mm-hmm. and he described his feelings about the experience, which are really beautiful if mm-hmm. you think about it. He said that he was basically overwhelmed by the experience. He became profoundly aware that each and every atom in the universe was connected in some way, and on seeing Earth from space, he had an understanding that all humans, animals, and systems were a part of the same thing, a synergistic whole. It was an interconnected euphoria.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interconnected euphoria. That sounds pretty intense.
Yeah. So you look at that experience and you start to consider it. And as scientists and neuroscientists are starting to look at it and you think, okay, well, what happened right before they had that euphoric experience? Mm-hmm. What are astronauts, spacewalkers? What are these people experiencing? Preceding that very moment.
Well, like even the pilots and airplanes that aren't even going into space. I mean, you're probably pulling some serious G's, and then you're looking out at, you know, perhaps the, you know, even the curvature of the Earth or something. And, I mean, even those guys were like, they were using language like, oh, I felt like a god, or I felt like I was king of the Earth, mm-hmm. or even this weird thing where they were like, I wanted to just fly on forever. I didn't, you know, care if there was any fuel, you know, so. So, but then taking it to the...
So they had like a Thelma and Louise moment?
Yeah, yeah, where they just want to just...
We'll just drive off the cliff of the universe?
Right off the cliff, yeah.
Wow.
So when you're going into space, though, it's that more complicated a journey. You know, it's a lot more effort to actually leave the atmosphere. So yeah, the experiences of getting there are definitely a little more taxing.
Yeah, so, I mean, you have written about this before in a blog post about how being out in space kind of makes you a little bit cranky.
Yeah.
And you talked about stage one.
Yeah, stage one is pretty cool. Well, I mean, they're all kind of cool and kind of frightening. But stage one is basically like a 26% drop in sleep efficiency, greater reduced rapid eye movement, and essentially you have dream deprivation. So you start feeling uncomfortable. You start feeling sluggish in your work. You know, it's like if you stay up all night and, you know, pull an all-nighter, then try to go to work the next day.
Right.
You know, you're going to feel a little slow. You may feel, you know, a little cranky even. And
it's like the beginning of a road trip.
Yeah. And plus, you're in space now where suddenly your sense of night and day is totally screwed up. Mm-hmm. Sleeping is a different ordeal. Your stomach's all, you know, messed up. You're probably having to take a little medication here and there to regulate what's night and what's day.
Right. You're like the Elvis of the cosmos.
Yeah, exactly. On your space toilet.
Which you hopefully get off of.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so basically, you're just sort of trying to acclimate to the atmosphere you're in, the environment you're in, the people you're with. And then stage two, that's sort of like the honeymoon period, right?
Yeah. Generally, this is about 6 weeks into a mission and you hit your stride. And you're generally going to have 6 additional weeks of having it all figured out. You got it. You know, you got your patterns down. Your stomach, I guess, has settled out a little and is not going crazy at every little thing. You figured out the most efficient way to go to the restroom, or I don't know, maybe you're still in a mode where you can hold it. I don't know how right. long, you know, a human can actually hold out, but if you really wanted to, maybe 12 12 weeks. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. That would be uncomfortable, I would say. Yes. That'd make me cranky. And then stage three, you start kind of sniping with each other, right? The honeymoon's over. Your crew members, your fellow crew members are driving you nuts.
Yeah, this is like, I think, like hour five of a terrestrial car trip, you know, road trip. You know, where suddenly everybody's been cramped up a little too long. You're getting a little short with everyone.
Right. You want to listen to your music.
Yeah. And a lot of this, they say, is linked to boredom and isolation, obviously.
Right.
You know, but some of the stuff was really interesting. They said that some of the studies I was looking at, they said that you'd have increased sensitivity to loud noises, changes in musical preference. So I guess suddenly, like, you're looking at your iPod and it's like, what was I thinking bringing all this AC/DC up here? All I want to do is listen to Pure Moods. And you're like,
right.
I left
or Barbra Streisand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a great reason to make sure that your MP3 player is loaded down.
Right.
Like, don't just put on all the rockin' music you're going to need for those first 12 weeks. You know, you're going to want to be prepared for maybe a little calmer listening later on.
Yeah. Bring some backup.
Yeah.
And then you've got stage four, right? So, and by the way, so, just to recap it, you've got fatigue, stress, you're feeling a little bit lonely, sensory deprivation, mm-hmm. you've got some bone mass loss going on.
Yeah.
Right? Poor oxygen at certain times.
Yes. They have sensors to regulate that, but you're probably encountering some poor oxygen from time to time. You can only clean yourself. I don't know about the rest of you people out there, but camping for me is kind of an ordeal because if I go like a day without taking a shower, I just feel like I'm doing something wrong.
Really?
Yeah. Like in the summer, I'll take two or three if I can get away with it in a day. I know that's not good for my skin, but man, there's nothing like a shower to like just change your outlook on life.
I guess that means I would be well suited to space travel.
Oh yeah.
I don't mind the funk.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it's a warning to others.
Well, that's the thing. It's you're going to have a number of people in a very enclosed environment, all using their funk as a warning to
right.
the.
Right. See, this is why this might be ideal for me.
Ideal. Well, a solo mission, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah. I don't know. You're right. But so all these things are happening, and then I kind of look at what stage four as sort of the extreme. Teenage mode where you just get super cranky because you know that the thing's going to come to a close pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
But is this also when euphoria might set in?
Yeah, this is when you start getting this one final symptom, and it is quote prevailing feelings of euphoria. This is we're getting into the overview effect territory here. This is linked to multiple accounts from astronauts. Of how their mental state is gone throughout a mission. Because, NASA, any of these space programs, they're very interested in the mental
right.
shape of their astronauts before, during, and after a trip.
And so this is an established pattern right here. So I think that's interesting to know that you have to undergo all these different sea changes in yourself
yeah.
before you get to experience euphoria. I think that gives us a clue.
Yeah, it's kind of like... my wife and I often will try and make this Friday evening relaxation yoga thing, and it's generally I'm just exceedingly cranky when I get there because I've just gotten home from working, you know, and she's just gotten home, and we're putting off having dinner till after yoga, so we're maybe a little what I think is known in scientific circles as hangry. This is when you're both hungry, you're angry, but it's due to hunger issues.
Right. Your blood sugar levels are nuts.
Yeah. So we're a little hangry. We've just been running nonstop and now we're at yoga and, you know, we get in there and granted there's, you know, some calming music and all, but then it's, you know, start getting into uncomfortable poses. And then this just makes me crankier. And then there's a karate, lesson going on in the room next to us. So it's like, I can't relax with karate going on next door. But then eventually at the very end, after all this like karate and yoga, it's like we start doing the relaxation mode, like I guess like an hour and a half in, and then you can actually relax. So I kind of get that impression from going into space. At the long end of this arduous process, suddenly all this insight starts happening.
So it's sort of like a release.
Yeah.
Is your hypothesis. That's,
well, sort of. That's sort of my hypothesis, yeah.
Yeah. No, I can see that.
Yeah. But like ESA, NASA reports, they document this and they refer to this feeling as, quote, is giving one, quote, new insights into the meaning of life and the unity of mankind.
Right. Yeah. And that, those are the implications that some people are trying to apply to humanity as a whole in a certain way, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But, I think that we want to look maybe a little bit more at this feeling of euphoria and question a little bit more, especially since you've already kind of talked about this release aspect of it.
Right.
And the fact that it is a pattern at that, you know, it happens after the following steps. So you got to wonder if the euphoric feeling that they're experiencing isn't necessarily something from beyond them, which is usually the case, that they feel like this is, not God so much, but a force outside of themselves that's acting on them,
right,
is the general impression that I get.
Yeah.
So you got to kind of wonder if this isn't coming from inside. If you look at their brain, has it changed a little bit? Are they having this experience because of all those different conditions that we talked about?
Yeah, like one thing that I found out when I was researching this is that if you go, you know, it's like space is travel. You know, when you go into space, you're traveling into an extreme environment, a very hostile environment, one where humans cannot really live unless they bring little encapsulations of their own environment up with them. The same is true of the deep ocean, where we have two different effects going on. There's one effect called rapture of the deep, also more commonly known, I guess, as nitrogen narcosis. And this starts hitting people at around 100 feet below sea level. It's also known as the martini effect, because the idea is that you start feeling the effects of one drink for every 33 feet below 65 feet.
Ah.
Yeah. I think it's been described as a beer buzz.
Okay.
That you experience. And then another deep sea, condition that is often encountered, or occasionally encountered anyway, is hydrogen narcosis. And this occurs if you hit 1,000 feet below sea level for 5 minutes or more. And with this, you can get hallucinations, disorientation, confusion. And again, these are very much, due to, physiological, conditions.
Right. So it could be a neurological event.
Right. Brown University, for instance, they conducted a 4-year study where they gauged the possible effects of thin air on astronauts by studying climbers, who are ascending Mount Everest, which Mount Everest is another one of these situations where you're entering a dangerous and extreme environment that people really, but health-wise, nobody should really go to the top of Mount Everest. It's not a good place when
unless
it comes to air quality.
You're Sherpa and you've been in that environment and you've been doing it as a young child and your lungs are gigantic.
Yeah, you've been lugging up like IMAX cameras your whole life and you know, all sorts of stuff so that some American dude from Vermont can stand on the top of the mountain and pretend he did it all himself.
Right.
Yeah, and then he's like, carry me down, I can't breathe. But
get the picture, hurry.
But they found that low oxygen environments can damage both the brain's, and I'm going to say this completely wrong, I'm sure, globus pallidus, which controls subconscious voluntary movements.
Okay.
And even the hippocampus. So the climbers in the study ended up exhibiting decreased cognitive capacity. Sentence comprehension fell off during the ascent. And one climber noted in the 2004 report, even fell to his death 2 days after being advised of his condition. So again, it's like suddenly your subconscious voluntary movements are taking a hit.
Mm-hmm.
Not an ideal situation while you're climbing Mount Everest.
No, that's
right.
Not where you want to be in the old mind game.
And then there was a 2008 study in the European Journal of Neurology. And they concluded that extremely high altitude exposures can permanently damage brain regions involved in motor activity.
Okay.
So, based on these studies, people at NASA, ESA, et cetera, are really into the idea of having of keeping these atmospheric monitors to keep an eye on oxygen levels.
Right.
Because just as you don't want decreased subconscious voluntary movements while you're climbing a mountain, you also don't want it like while you're on a spacewalk or while you're trying to do some experiment about tiny screws.
Right. And you also don't want people to go nuts up there too. So I'm sure that they've got vested interest in making sure that everybody is psychologically safe. And in fact, don't they have some sort of virtual psychologist program?
Yeah, they've been working on it because they would really, like, if you've seen the movie Moon, I don't know if you've...
I haven't seen that.
Okay. Well, the movie Moon, which stars Sam Rockwell, has this robot computer voiced by Kevin Spacey that kind of checks in with him and sees how, and, you know, finds out how he's doing emotionally and mentally throughout the picture. And that's exactly the kind of thing NASA has been looking at. And it would basically be kind of like, you know, these little personality tests you take online.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of like that. You take that every few days and then the computer monitors you to see if you're starting to exhibit signs of craziness.
Okay. I can't help but think of like 2001 and like having Hal as your psychologist, you know. Hopefully that wouldn't happen. I'm sure
it
wouldn't.
Well, hopefully the computer would not go crazy.
Yeah, and start just messing with you.
Yeah.
You're not feeling so great, are you? Okay, so I think all of these things are kind of spelling out something about maybe it being more of an internal thing, even though the hopes are that it would be, this euphoric feeling might be some sort of universal truth about our unitedness as humanity, so
right.
to speak.
Yeah,
not like, so eloquently, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think on one level, there's often a tendency to equate it more with, you know, just sort of spiritual awakening. But I think if we've examined here, there's definitely a biological side to it.
Again, right.
End of a grueling trip in an extreme environment. Possibly some oxygen issues going on. And then there's just the blatant fact that's easy to overlook here. You're in space looking at the Earth.
Right.
It's
going to mess with you.
Yeah. It's an incredible experience by all accounts.
Right. It's something that you can't really comprehend, right?
Yeah. Like,
I mean, it's outside of our understanding.
Right. Like you yourself, have you ever encountered, like, just seen a sight, you know, be it a, you know, a breathtaking vista or, you know, or something in the sky that's just really just blown your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about the Grand Canyon. I'm not trying to belittle the experience by saying it's like the Grand Canyon, because you just said, I mean, it's beyond, you know, our understandings, and you see something like that. You see the Earth from a distance like that, and you see the weather patterns going on. You must be like, oh my God, this thing is beautiful. And that's why astronauts like fall in love. They go gaga over Earth
right.
and just start thinking, oh, we're all one. But, you know, just on a smaller scale, I think about the Grand Canyon and you look at it and if it's something that you've never seen before, or a geological structure like that, then all of a sudden you have a completely different understanding of the Earth underneath your feet. And you start to sort of reconsider the way, at least that was my experience being there, is understand, humanity a little bit different, or even, it just gives you a historical perspective.
Yeah. Like, I think even, like, take city dwellers, for instance. I think we can get a slice of that cake just by going out to a rural setting, or, you know, going out into some sort of a national park environment, and suddenly you're just in an entirely different environment, and you can be like, whoa, look at this. There's nature happening all around me, and and you can suddenly feel this oneness with this biodiversity and the system that's branching out all around you.
Yeah. I also think too about how, and you and I had talked about this before, about how sometimes you can come back from space and you don't have that euphoric feeling. In fact, you feel anxious and fearful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The studies by NASA, ESA, et cetera, they also recognize that some people came back feeling a little freaked out by the whole experience.
Yeah, and it kind of makes me think of LSD and tripping.
Yeah, you hear it's, you know, it's kind of like you have the classic stories, especially the ones that that showed up in different films aimed at young people in the 60s, where people freak out and, you know, try and force themselves through a keyhole or jump out of a window, and then you have
or peel themselves because they think they're an orange.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
that kind of thing, and then the other sort of traditional, hippie sort of thing where people, you know, take this and then feel totally in touch with the universe.
Right. The doors of perception fly open.
Yeah.
And you're suddenly Terrence McKenna.
Yeah.
And you're communing with aliens and so on and
now,
so forth.
Now, speaking of aliens, I mean, that's the thing. Sometimes you come back from space and you experience the overview effect and you found, what kind of sounds like a religion, right?
Yeah. Sometimes you do.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's the hinky part of it, right?
Yeah. Tell us about this.
All right. So you come back and your name is Edgar Mitchell.
Uh-huh.
And you had that experience that we talked about, where he was basically saying he felt this oneness and you feel like you've got to do something about it. And so you start, noetic science, or what it would be the seeds for noetic science, which I think is the Institute of Noetic Sciences, I believe.
Yeah.
And you really try to take that philosophy, that overwhelming feeling that we all are part of one system, and apply it to human consciousness mm-hmm. by using science. So it's interesting. It's a great proposition. I mean, who wouldn't want us to all become better human beings
It's a great message.
Yeah. The problem is, I think that, you know, I know, is that some of the studies that they're carrying out, you have to be a little bit skeptical about. And that would be like healing through distances, for instance. So if, you know, I've got cancer and I've got a group of Buddhist monks praying for me on the other side of the ocean, that might somehow affect my ability to heal myself. Well, that's a little bit of a suspicious argument. You know, it's, that's where you kind of look at the message and you think, okay, love the message, but I'm not sure that we can actually translate this into stuff that's going to be practical for us.
Right. Or certainly if it's a great practical message, it doesn't mean we necessarily need to prop it up with science. I mean, it's when things are kind of like of a spiritual, religious nature, I'm more of the mindset, like, don't try and prove that with science. I mean, it's its own thing.
Right. Yeah. Embrace it for what it is and just say, you know what, it was a personal experience.
Right. Make no mistake, though, I'm totally fine with scientific explorations of religious claims.
Sure.
That's totally valid.
Yeah. And I think you and I discussed this before, too, that it seems like this is such a personal perspective mm-hmm. that it's hard to create something so personal through one's own filter and apply it in a universal way.
Right.
But, you know, I think that it's really interesting what they're trying to explore with this. And in fact, Andy Newberg, he's a neuroscientist and he's got some experience in space medicine. He's hoping to find out whether there is an actual psychological phenomenon by scanning the brain pre and post space travel. So I haven't been able to find any follow up information on that, whether or not he's been successful in doing so, but I think that's the first line of trying to apply some science to it to see what is actually mm-hmm. happening in the brain.
Well, it seems perfectly valid because we've discussed before how like having a year of piano lessons can change your brain.
Yeah,
you know. So if piano lessons can change your brain, which I took piano lessons and I remember very little of it, I imagine something as memorable as a trip into orbit would rearrange your thinking a bit.
Oh, yeah. Change you forever. And then do you also have the Overview Effect Institute? And they actually want to try to reproduce this at a level that everybody could experience it. So they're kind of thinking about it as some sort of video iPod-like device that could deliver a dose of Overview Effect and let everyone experience that euphoria.
So just like, it'd be kind of like watching 2001 on IMAX or something. That's their whole thing.
Perhaps, or trying to maybe recreate that sense of wonder and that sort of, again, that oceanic feeling of oneness.
Huh.
Which I would sign up for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, if you could induce that.
Good.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
Yeah, I can't help but wonder if we reach the point where we decide, yeah, sending people into space totally changes the way you look at the world, makes you a more spiritual person or something. You know, might we reach the point where we're taking criminals and miscreants and instead of sending them into prisons or even terrestrial rehabilitation programs, we just start shooting them into space? I mean, bringing them back. That's key. but shooting them up on Virgin Galactic, eight at a time, they all come back and they're instantly enlightened.
So
I don't think that'll happen, but it's a beautiful idea.
Did you talk to Richard Branson's guy about that?
I did not. I should have asked him. I wish I'd thought to. I could have been like, hey, are there any plans to fill any of these early flights up with murderers? And they would have probably said no.
Probably not.
Yeah.
I think they'd have to change the name.
Yeah.
Too. I don't, you know, Virgin Galactic miscreants.
Yeah. Cause I imagine the early flights are all going to be, you know, celebrities and, you know, self-made millionaires and billionaires. So
okay,
they're probably
so,
not going to want to sit next to people that are in chains.
Well, so that's kind of not fair. Do they all get to be shot up into space and then become enlightened? Is that Is that what we're
I'm hoping for.
To?
Like, I'm really, you know, they don't release the info about who has purchased tickets unless
right.
the person who's purchased the ticket or reserved the tickets is actually outspoken about it. And I really am looking forward to the first, rapper hip hop artist that goes into space, experiences the overview effect, and then comes back and shares that with the world, through music. That's going to be amazing.
That's going to be the best rap ever.
Yeah. I'm really hoping it's Ludacris. So, Ludacris,
yeah.
if you're listening, book that flight, man.
That's right, man. Oh, okay, so do we have any listener mail? Seems like our inbox has been busy lately.
Yes, I received a cool email from a listener by the name of Anne, and she had a few thoughts about our podcast, Creatures Are Sleeping, which dealt with everything from unihemispheric sleep to what our cats are doing when they're laying there in funny shapes. And she pointed out, she said, quote, if you haven't checked out Mike Birbiglia's interview on NPR, and she gave a link, he has rapid eye movement behavior disorder and once ran out of a second story window of a hotel while asleep. He's also a great comedian and just wrote a book called Sleepwalk With Me and Other Painfully True Stories. And I don't know if you've listened to Mike Birbiglia any?
No.
Okay.
That is awful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's comedy gold, but it's awful.
Yeah, he's worth looking up. He also has been featured on the Moth podcast.
Okay.
Which is like storytelling, situations. And, I think also on This American Life. But yeah, he suffers from this really kind of horrible sleep, disturbance and has a humorous outlook on it, even though he's doing things like leaping through glass windows and having to explain to hotel clerks that he's, quote, like the Hulk, and then getting checked into the hospital and all. But I found that amusing, and so I thank Anne for bringing that to our attention. Also received some cool thoughts about our Inside Out People podcast, mm-hmm. where we discussed
Eversion.
Yeah. And we had a listener by the name of Keith who pointed out that there's a Mythbusters episode on differential pressure and diving suits. So that's worth checking out if you want a little more things or people possibly, but not really, turning inside out. And we also discussed cartoons, right? And how I was a little shocked that there were so many like children's cartoons where people or animals turn inside out.
Yeah, where your fear of being turned inside out was manifested.
Yeah, and we had a listener by the name of Brad who pointed out on our Facebook page that in SpongeBob SquarePants there is a character named Squidward, and he becomes turned inside out at one point. And the interesting thing about this is the creator of SpongeBob is he has a background in marine biology. So it makes total sense that that would pop up at some point during that show's long run.
Right.
Because, as we discussed in the podcast, things that live in the ocean are just always everting themselves.
Like sea cucumbers who have 900 or no, like 1,000 haiku dedicated to them.
Yes.
In Japanese culture.
Sharks that vomit up their stomach like a like somebody turning their pocket inside out to get rid of lint. So anyway, if you want to point anything out to us on Facebook or Twitter, you can find us at both places as Blow the Mind.
And speaking of sea creatures, we are still getting our sea legs as a podcast, as Stuff to Blow Your Mind. So please share your thoughts with us. Let us know what you like, what you don't like. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Oh, hi. I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics, in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.